is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Welcoming my colleague, Joseph Umar, the executive director of Secure Free Society, publishing in North America the publication of UNAM, that's the Autonomous University of Mexico, observations about the Trump administration, Trump 1, and anticipating what Trump 2 would look like, especially in terms of the Americas, Mexico being a major country, but all countries looking in because of the turmoil of these last years. Joseph, congratulations. This is an academic journal, and so therefore it's got footnotes. However, reading your argument, very recognizable given that we speak often, and I have a sense of your understanding of what the problems are. But I want to begin as you anticipate a second Trump administration. You illustrate the Trumpist approach in terms of bottoms up. But he learned that as a young man growing up in Queens, and then he was in the military academy, and then he plunged into Queens real estate and then Manhattan real estate. What do you mean by bottoms up foreign policy? Good evening to you, Joseph.
Good evening, John. And first, let me just say it's quite an honor to have the ability to get a peer-reviewed article published in a prominent academic journal, probably the largest public university in all of Latin America, which is UNAM, in Mexico being our largest trade partner. So I felt very honored for that. And then so when I did this, I actually wrote this last year, John, and when I began this, I really wanted to explain how President Trump, America First foreign policy, and then what they call Trumpism, really was an extension of phenomenons that predated the 2016 election. It wasn't that President Trump created this. He actually capitalized on the moment, which is what, you know, politics is really all about, of a moment that existed prior to President Trump and is related to other phenomenons around the world, like Brexit and other places. But the reason I think President Trump had his kind of finger on the pulse on this movement, on this momentum, was because of his upbringing. And I spoke to a few people that are very close to President Trump in New York, and they told me that, you know, the accusations of racism and all these things that we saw early on when he first entered politics really didn't jive with the people that knew him, because they knew that he grew up and was considered the most linguistically diverse place on the planet, which is Queens, New York, where you have ethnicities from all over the world that are basically mingling in business and trade and, you know, all kinds of activities in Queens. So the fact that he grew up in that environment, I think, made him understand foreign cultures, made him understand the international community, and made him understand how people from different parts of the world can come together and kind of, you know, move in the same direction. At least at one point they were. So the bottom-up approach part, John, comes from basically listening to Americans, listening to people, listening to even foreigners, residents in the United States that are usually, it's like what they call the taxi cab test, or maybe called the Uber test, where you go to a foreign country and the first thing you ask your Uber driver is, what do you think about the politics? And sometimes it's more clear than when you have conversations with the foreign ministry or other diplomats, which is much more nuanced and sometimes convoluted. So I think President Trump is much more of an instinctual president. It's what many people told me. And a lot of his instincts come, as for many people do, from his background and his upbringing. And if you grew up in Queens, New York, if there's one thing you could say about people that grew up in Queens, New York, as they're not ignorant of foreign cultures. That's almost impossible. And I think that he brought that and in many ways kind of had that grassroots understanding from his upbringing.
What I thought of immediately, because we've talked about it recently, is Guyana, a very small state, which is now under threat of Venezuela, because I learned that a large Guyanese diaspora lives in Brooklyn and Queens, and in fact have a great deal to say about what should happen, and a very large part of it is in Hakeem Jeffries' district, the minority leader of the United States House of Representatives. So that what you're recommending is in fact foreign policy in New York City, because we know that people are Americans, but at the same time they are very keen on their sense of origin and their neighbor's sense of origin. And that's how I understood Queen's approach. It wasn't until I got to New York that I understand that every language on the planet is spoken on the subway, every language I can imagine. That isn't something you know in suburban Philadelphia. I think you understand, Joe.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of the same take I got. And obviously, I visited New York, I visited Queens many times. And, you know, for Latin America, I mean, the Caribbean, you mentioned the Guyanese, that's absolutely the largest diaspora, Guyanese in the United States, probably the only really large one. that's based in Queens in New York. The Jamaicans have a big diaspora in New York. The Colombians used to have a bigger diaspora in Queens, and they moved more to New Jersey, but they nonetheless are still pretty well represented. The Dominicans, I think, are all over New York. And so in Latin America, you can learn a lot about the Caribbean, about parts of South and Central America, just being in New York. If I juxtapose that with where I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., Salvador is the biggest diaspora that you have, and not many people know a lot about Salvadorians. I fortunately do, because I grew up with Salvadorians as my neighbors pretty much from all of my childhood. So those formative experiences, you know, people discount it when we get into high-end foreign policy, but they make a difference in the framing of someone's perspective. And I think President Trump brought this. You know, President Reagan was considered kind of like an instinctual president. Didn't grow up, obviously, in Queens, grew up in California, but he had someone that had a bit more of a touch with the common person, the common ordinary citizen and resident inside the United States. And so I started the article from that perspective because I wanted to make sure people understand this is not your typical politician. This is not someone that comes from the brain thrust of Washington, D.C. or becomes from the academic community. That's why his foreign policy doesn't fit into a traditional international relations framework. He's constructivist on some things. He's a realist on other things. He's interventionist in some areas. He's an isolationist in other areas. So it really is a mixed mash. But it really, I think, comes down to what most people, I think, would recognize as his instincts.
Globalization. The globalization as we conceived it at the turn of the century with the Chinese miracle, with the Y2000 disaster escaped. Everything was going to go so easily. No one would go to war again. The Soviet Union was defeated. It hasn't worked out that way. I note that the Houthis are bombarding the Red Sea traffic, interrupting global flow. At the same time, we've had a computer glitch that isn't yet solved, reminding all of us that when you integrate with the world, that makes you vulnerable to anything that happens in the world. And then there was the pandemic. Now, Mr. Trump had an administration that mostly got through the first term without the pandemic, without failure at the scale of the Houthis, but we're concentrating on the Americas. The Americas, to my reading, Joe, did not enjoy globalization as prosperity, with the possible exceptions of Mexico. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I think that, you know, really what I was trying to do with that section was just trying to, what I was saying before, is to draw a cause and effect to how President Trump rose to politics, kind of part of a wave that you could argue really began around 2019, this sort of anti-globalization movement. You could trace it back to the Tea Party on the right and to the Occupy Wall Street movement on the left, really started to bubble around this time. And the sentiments that have drastically different principles were kind of centered around this idea that the globalization has flaws. And I think that that started to become evident as time went on. One of the data points that really caught my attention, this probably was the biggest data point that I included in the article, was in 2009, for the first time in 20 years, which you could consider 1989 to 2009, the era of hyper-globalization, when the world kind of connected itself. But in 2009, after the financial crisis, we started to see a slowdown in international trade. International trade began to grow slower than global GDP. Imports as a percentage of GDP began to drop, meaning that countries started to regionalize or even in some case internalize into their trade system. The United States is primarily a regional trade system with our two big trade partners, Canada and Mexico. Latin America is a regional trade. I mean, with the pivot to Asia, China came in, but nonetheless, their main trade partners are usually their neighbors. And there's actually a good book by a scholar from the Council for Foreign Relations, Shannon O'Neill, who talks about it's not so much that we're going to a deglobalization moment, we're going to a regionalization moment where countries are looking at their neighbors as a way to create markets that are consumer on shorter supply chains, so they have less risks to global shocks. You mentioned CrowdStrike. That was a huge global shock. But obviously, if you're just doing it between two neighboring countries, there's alternative methods of travel, alternative methods of trade that can be resolved. And so I think that this kind of era of deglobalizing the world, which is accelerated because of the pandemic and because of the war in Ukraine, I think President Trump was ahead of the curve on that in terms of foreign policy and made it a big part of his foreign policy when he was president of the United States.
I'm speaking with Joseph Umar, the executive director of Secure Free Society, of an article that he's publishing in North America, which is a peer-reviewed journal from the Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM. We now have identified some of the challenges. When we come back, what is to be done? Presuming that the Trump administration begins in January of 2025. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.